from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we'll get a live update from National Public Radio's Jason Beaubien, who is in Haiti. Then award-winning author and UCLA professor Jared Diamond will be joining us. And we'll discuss with him the reasons why Haiti, now undergoing so much ongoing tragedy in the wake of the earthquake, is so impoverished compared with the Dominican Republic, which shares the same island. The Dominican Republic is far less deforested than Haiti, has a much lower infant mortality rate, far fewer cases of AIDS and fewer malnourished children, as well as a working democracy that provides basic services. Why not in Haiti? We'll find out with Jared Diamond, and we'll take your calls, emails, and postings. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. We are going to update you on what is going on in Haiti as soon as we connect with NPR reporter Jason Beaubien, who is there. But in the meantime, we are going to talk with Jared Diamond, who is best known for his highly acclaimed best-selling work, Guns, Gems, and Steel. He's professor of geography and physiology at UCLA. He's also the author of Collapse and soon to be published next month by Harvard University Press, a book called National Experiments of History. And in the fourth chapter of that book, he takes up the question of why Haiti, which was once far richer and more powerful than the eastern half of the island of Hispaniola that it shared with what was to become the Dominican Republic, is now the poorest country in the Americas and one of the world's poorest countries. And Jared Diamond joins us from his home in L.A. under siege a bit with the weather. Good to have you with us. Good morning.
Yes, it's nice to be here in my dry room.
Well, this whole question about Haiti's poverty that you take up in the fourth chapter of your forthcoming book is really fascinating because it was once, as I said, the wealthier part of that world of Hispaniola, and it went into poverty largely as you bring to our attention for a number of reasons. Let's kind of look at them one by one. Environmental, first of all.
Yes, there was an environmental reason, but again, just to frame the question, not only was Haiti the richer part, Haiti used to be the richest colony in the world. It accounted for something like half of the foreign exchange income of France due to its very rich sugar plantations. It was far richer than the Dominican side. In fact, it conquered and annexed the Dominican side for 20 years. So why on earth has Haiti gone from such great wealth to being the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere? The reasons are partly environmental, but they're mainly social consequences of colonial history and what happened afterwards.
And I want to talk with you about those. I thought we'd start with environmental simply because you start with the environmental and you talk about deforestation and you talk about the soil and just the land, really, and how poor it was in terms of really giving forth what is necessary as far as resources.
Yes, the land itself. So Haiti shares a big island called Hispaniola with another country, the Dominican Republic. The rains come from the east. The Dominican Republic is the eastern half of the island. Haiti is the western half. And because the rains come from the east, the Dominican side is wetter. The Haitian side is drier. The Dominican side is less steep. The Haitian side is steeper, which means more prone to landslides and mudslides and soil erosion. And the Dominican side has deeper, more fertile soils. So part of the reason why Haiti went downhill is environmental penalties of being drier and steeper and more prone to erosion and deforestation. But that leaves the puzzle. Why, despite these environmental disadvantages, did Haiti initially start out far richer than the Dominican side and then go downhill?
Well, and then you do get into the cultural histories, and slave culture has a good deal to do with it, and so it turns out does language.
Slave culture, which resulted in differences in language and in reactions to slave culture. This is a real natural experiment of history. By that I mean that if you want to find out things about history, and if I were an immoral, all-powerful Martian, I could come to Earth and I could quickly discover the differences between red and blue states in the United States by drawing a line and killing all the blue people on one side and all the red people on the other side. And quickly I would find out about differences between red and blue states. But that's not nice and it's difficult to do and it's immoral. Nevertheless, sometimes that sort of thing happens as a natural experiment. And it did happen on the island of Hispaniola. The Spanish colonized Hispaniola, set up their capital in the east, and French pirates who were running around trying to sequester Spanish galleons, therefore set up their capital on the west, and the result was that the western half of Hispaniola became a French colony, Saint-Domingue, and the eastern half remained a Spanish colony. But in the 1700s, France was rich, Spain was poorer. Spain had other valuable colonies, Peru, Mexico, Bolivia, to which Spain paid attention, France less so. And so France used its money to import lots of slaves into the western half of Hispaniola and develop extremely profitable sugar plantations. But Spain was not importing lots of slaves. And a consequence is the language difference that you mentioned. With a population 85% Afro-American in Haiti, they developed their own special language, Haitian Creole, that's spoken by nobody except the Haitians, whereas in the Dominican Republic, where just 10 to 15% slaves, they continued speaking Spanish, which is one of the three big languages of the world today. So that helped keep the Dominican Republic connected to the world and Haiti isolated from the world.
In fact, you call it linguistic isolation.
It is linguistic isolation. If you speak a language that nobody else speaks, you are linguistically isolated.
And that's true pretty much to this day. About 90% of Haitians speak this Creole?
That's right. 85 and 90% speak Creole. The elite of Haiti speaks French. And the elite has continued to look to France. They send their children, have sent their children to France for education in the majority, and they drink good French wines, and they live in a separate suburb of the capital. So in Haiti, there's this social and linguistic elite between this social and linguistic gap between the governing elite and the large mass of the population.
So in really figuring out what is responsible for the poverty, as you look historically at the two parts of the island, you certainly bring in the environment and then you bring in the cultural and linguistic differences. But perhaps one of the major differences has been government. And now we're seeing very little in the way of basic services or infrastructure, government in Haiti compared to the Dominican Republic. And we may want to examine some of those statistics. But what I was interested to learn, and you use the word evil for both dictators, for the major dictators, Trujillo in the Dominican Republic and the Duvaliers in Haiti, but quite a vast difference between the way they dictatored, so to speak.
That's a wonderful word. Two dictator, two have been dictatored. I'm going to remember that one. Yes, both halves of the island had perhaps the two most evil dictators in New World history. In the east, the dictator of the Dominican Republic was Rafael Trujillo from the 1930s until he was assassinated, probably with CIA help, around 1971, while the dictator of the Haitian half was Papa Doc Duvalier, who eventually died and was succeeded by a son, Baby Doc Duvalier, who was expelled and is still alive. But those two dictators were very different. The Dominican side of the island, because it speaks Spanish and was regarded favorably by Europeans and Americans who traded with and sent immigrants to the Dominican side. The Dominican side has always been more connected to the outside world, and that was also true of their dictator Trujillo. Trujillo, when he became Dominican dictator, wanted to get rich, and the way to get rich was to build up businesses to export. Trujillo himself personally owned all the businesses of the Dominican Republic, including their chocolate factories and their shipping lines. Trujillo even took a cut of the earnings of prostitutes, but Trujillo developed the Dominican Republic for his own advantage. Whereas on the Haitian side, Haiti, with its tradition of being isolated from the outside world and also being shunned by the outside world, the last thing that Europe and the United States wanted was to see a former slave colony that had thrown out its white masters succeed. So the Haitians were leery of foreign investment and foreigners were leery of investing in Haiti. Duvalier continued in that tradition. And so the Dominican Republic got developed economically by this evil dictator Trujillo, and that was much less the case in Haiti.
Jared Diamond with us from Los Angeles. We're going to continue this discussion about looking into the reasons behind the poverty and the staggering nature of that poverty in Haiti compared to the other nation on this island of Hispaniola that became the nation of the Dominican Republic. Before we continue with Professor Diamond, though, I want to go to Port-au-Prince. We've got Jason Bobian on the line with us, who is an NPR reporter, former KQED reporter, and he is there. And Jason, we welcome you. I guess the first question is the aid getting through to the best of your observational powers?
Some aid is getting through. Some aid is getting through. But we drove around just this morning, and we just went around saying, is anyone distributing aid around here? And just time after time, people looked at us like we were crazy, just saying, no, no. We're saying, oh, we've heard there's an aid distribution. No, we have seen nothing. We've seen nothing. And most Haitians that you ask, people who are sleeping out on the street, who had their homes completely destroyed in this earthquake, they will tell you that they've gotten very little, if any, aid at all.
What about the mood now, particularly after the aftershock? I'm sure was even more traumatic following what had occurred with the initial earthquake and the aftershocks that followed it. Just a big one yesterday again.
It's really difficult to even sort of understand, you know, when these walls came crumbling down a week ago on Tuesday and the place shook, the level of fear that instilled into people and, you know, Haitians that I'm meeting and talking to, this aftershock, which was a really solid jolt yesterday morning, just brought all that fear racing right back and made it, you know, clear that more of this could be coming. So people are very much on edge, and they're on edge in a city that's really destroyed. This city is, parts of it are completely wiped out. Just how every building in certain blocks, certain areas are down. The infrastructure has fallen apart. It's really hard to even describe the scale of the devastation that this earthquake on Port-au-Prince.
Is there any kind of government functioning that you can discern?
There's not much government functioning here. To some degree, some of the Haitian construction crew have gotten out in the streets, and they've been clearing the streets, which has been great, and clearing things up. But again, the Haitian construction company has been out with big trucks delivering water. The police today, after some really heavy looting yesterday, have gotten down in the street and are sort of doing roadblocks down in the commercial district. But there's really a sense that there is no government here. Because if you look around, I'm right now I'm standing in front of the presidential palace, and it has fallen in. You look over to the tax collection agency, it has fallen in. Government agency after government agency, their buildings are just lying in piles of rubble. There's very much a sense that this quake brought down the government. And we haven't heard from President Rene Préval hardly at all. So, yes, there's a sense that this is a place without a government right now.
We're talking to NPR reporter Jason Bobian, who is with us from Port-au-Prince. Can you, perhaps before we say goodbye to you, give us a sense, characterize for us just how dire the ongoing medical situation is there?
Well, right now I'm actually at the presidential palace because they're airlifting people from the general hospital, which is just behind here, and they're using the lawn of the presidential palace, the U.S. Navy is, to move injured people out to the U.S. naval ship Comfort, which is out in the harbor. These are people with crushed limbs, severe fractures, and the facilities, the general hospital, was damaged quite severely in the quake. They're getting it up and running again. They're cleaning out rooms. They're trying to get operating theaters going again. But the fact that this Navy ship, the Comfort, is here, it's going to provide extra emergency rooms, which are direly needed at the moment for people who have been waiting at this point, obviously, more than a week to have major surgery.
Jason, we thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Michael.
That's NPR's Jason Beaubien, who is in Port-au-Prince. We wanted to get an update for you. We've been talking with Jared Diamond, who is with us by phone from Los Angeles and who takes up the whole question of Haitian poverty and why Haiti, which was the western half of the island of Hispaniola, became so impoverished, and the eastern half, the Dominican Republic, has prospered to a much greater extent. And Jared Diamond, it's maybe a hypothetical question to a great degree, but if this kind of devastating earthquake had hit the Dominican Republic today, would we have seen anything even as staggering in terms of casualties that we're seeing, like we're seeing in Haiti?
Yes and no. In the first 10 seconds after the earthquake hits, people can get killed whichever side comes on. But a different, let's think not just of the Dominican Republic, but also the United States and Japan and Italy, which have also had earthquakes. First of all, when the earthquake hits in the United States and to a lesser extent the Dominican Republic, there are building codes. Buildings are required to be built so that they resist earthquakes. Here in Los Angeles, we had a big earthquake in 1994, which provoked a redo of our building code so that my university, UCLA, just had to spend $1 billion rebuilding its hospital to fit earthquake codes. Therefore, when the earthquake hits, more people are going to get killed in a place like Haiti where they aren't effective earthquake-proof building codes than if the earthquake hits San Francisco or the East Bay. That's the first thing. Second thing is that when the earthquake hits in the United States or in the Dominican Republic, there's an effective government that is able to intervene and have open hospitals and have police and have fire and emergency help. In Haiti, the government is much less effective and has been less capable of intervening. That's why there's the massive foreign aid, UN intervention going on now in Haiti, whereas when East Bay had its earthquake a dozen or so years ago, you did not have the Dominican Republic and Japan sending aid to East Bay. The United States and California is quite capable of taking care of itself. That's not true for Haiti.
Well, as you point out in Chapter 4, in your book that will be coming out from Harvard University Press next month, the Haitian government is unable to provide most of its citizens with even the most basic services, water, electricity, sewage disposal, education. That was true before the earthquake.
That's true. Even before the earthquake, Haiti was the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere and one of the poorest in the world, with a government unable to provide basic services such as electricity and sewage and water and schooling to much of the population. It's a cruel trick of fate that a country that was already poor, with desperately poor, with poor governmental capacity, has been hit with this major disaster. But that weakness of the Haitian government stems from two centuries of increasingly grinding poverty and from the gap between the elite pursuing their own interests and the 85% rest of the population, whose interests the elite have not been promoting, and by the language gap between the governors and the governed in Haiti.
Well, we're also mindful of the fact when we read your article that just taking into account public health and what has transpired over the years in Haiti with respect to responsiveness to a health crisis of any kind, that the infant mortality rate and the number of malnourished children, the number of cases of malaria, the number of cases of AIDS compared again to the Dominican Republic, the other part of Hispaniola, is really pretty dramatic.
That's right. Again, even before the earthquake hit, to understand why injured people who have had smashed limbs after 1 week are finally being taken out to a U.S. hospital ship rather than treated 1 hour later in the emergency room of 17 different major hospitals in the capital of Haiti. The pre-existing differences were that the Dominican Republic, the eastern half of the island, even though it has a smaller population than the Haitian half, the Dominican Republic has 8 times more doctors. It has only 1/11 as many people suffering with AIDS. It has only 1/7 as many malaria patients. It has perhaps 1/3 as many infant deaths. So that the Dominican side, as a result of being wealthier and of having a better functioning government was already in a much better state as regards health and public health.
You'd also mentioned before the fact that there was a great deal of resistance in Haiti to Europeans coming in and investing or having European immigrants come in. And some of this, I suppose, really needs to be connected to the revolution, does it not?
Oh, it is connected directly to the revolution. Just think of how the revolution played out in the former French colony of Saint-Domingue on the western half of Hispaniola. So here is this slave revolt by the black population against their French masters. The slave revolt flares up, goes on for about a dozen years. The French finally say that they will negotiate with the leader of the slave revolt, and when he comes in to negotiate, the French grab him and ship him off to prison in France, where he dies. Napoleon sends an army to reconquer Haiti, but the army is decimated by yellow fever, and finally the French give up. So the Haitian slaves have now got their independence. Naturally, they pursue their own self-interest. The first thing they do is to kill as many whites as possible, so that they will not be reconquered. And then when they establish a constitution, into the constitution they write that whites and foreigners cannot own land or cannot invest in Haiti, because the last thing they want to do is to allow the French to do what the French tried, namely to retake control of Haiti. That's written into the Haitian Constitution. But then there's the flip side of this. Look at it from the American perspective and the European perspective. In the 1800s, Europeans and the United States were terrified about the prospect of a slave revolt in their own lands. The last thing that we Americans and Europeans wanted was to see a slave revolt succeeding. So Europe and the United States did not want to see independent slave Haiti make a success of itself. Even if Haiti had wanted European investment, the United States and Europe were not prepared to invest in Haiti. They had a vested interest in seeing Haiti fail. In fact, the French imposed, of all things, reparations or compensation on Haiti. Haiti, for about 80 years after independence, incredibly had to pay large sums of money to France because of France being deprived of its slave plantations. And that money could have been used to build up Haitian infrastructure, but instead it was being shipped off to France.
I suppose the revolt, for example, of Nat Turner gave Americans great pause in light of Toussaint L'Ouverture.
Sure. Again, just imagine imagine the American reaction. Consider the American reaction to John Brown's attack on Harper's Ferry, or to the incipient slave revolts in the South. The United States, particularly Southerners, did everything possible to make sure that those slave revolts did not succeed. And by the same token, they wanted to make sure that Haiti, a country that had a successful slave revolt, was not going to succeed economically.
Our guest is Jared Diamond. He is with us from Los Angeles. He is the author of Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse, and his most recent book, Natural Experiments of History, will be published next month. There's a whole chapter that deals specifically with natural experiments of borders. It's about intra-island and inter-island comparisons, but he speaks specifically about Haiti and the Dominican Republic, which, of course, share the island of Hispaniola. If you'd like to join us, we welcome your calls, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, and you can also leave questions and comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And when we return, we'll hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we spoke with Jason Beaubien earlier, who is Mexico City correspondent for National Public Radio, joined us from Port-au-Prince in Haiti and gave us a report from really what's going on in Port-au-Prince now and in Haiti. And Jared Diamond is with us by phone, and we're talking to him about Haiti, specifically about the differences in, reasons, really, behind Haiti's poverty and being so dramatically impoverished as a nation in this part of the world and throughout the world, for that matter. He's professor of geography at UCLA and the author of Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse. Most recent book, which will be out next month, is Natural Experiments of History. And I'm going to go to your phone calls in just a moment. I want to go to some emails, though, that have come in here. And the first one, Professor Diamond, comes from a listener named Todd, who says, Francophone Africa does not have the English system of laws and education. I've heard these differences in colonial legacy had a strong influence. Were similar forces at work in Haiti?
That's a really interesting question. As you point out, France and England have had different legal codes, and France exported its legal code to its colonies, just as England exported its legal code to its colonies, including the United States, so that the legal code of the United States today is English-derived rather than French-derived. There have been discussions among historians about whether the English legal code is better than the French legal code, and you may not be surprised to hear that English and American historians tend to have negative views of the French legal code. The French do not see it that way. I would say, however, that the legal code is the least of Haiti's problems.
Well, here's a listener who writes, I have no doubt that Haiti's natural resources and environmental constraints explain part of its historical development, but Professor Diamond's explanation of Haiti's predicament seems far too reductionistic. For much of the past 75 years, Haiti has been plagued by a corrupt and inept government that has failed to enforce property rights and make critical investments in infrastructure, education, and health care. In addition, much of Haitian culture is fatalistic, as evidenced by the preoccupation with voodoo religious elements. It mystifies me why Professor Diamond has such contempt for the role of social science, particularly economics, in explaining failed states such as Haiti.
That listener should be applauding and praising me rather than condemning me. I've emphasized that environmental factors are the smaller part of the explanation for the differences between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and the major factors are the social and cultural factors to which I've devoted a whole chapter of my book. And just to recapitulate them, those social and cultural factors include colonization by France rather than Spain, France being rich, Spain being interested in other things, France importing lots of slaves, Spain fewer, the French part, Haiti, having a separate language, the Dominican part having an international language, Spanish, the different courses of governments, the isolation between the elite and the population on the Haitian side, more than the Dominican side, the difference between the dictators. So let your listener praise me for my detailed explanation of the social and cultural factors.
I'll try to rectify the listener's point of view there, but what about the point he makes about the fatalism of voodoo and other religious practices in Haiti? By contrast,
one often hears about the fatalism of voodoo, and for example, Duvalier, dictator of Haiti, had an expression, the Haitian people are born to suffer. On the other hand, the fact is that Haitian people are hardworking and have gone to massive efforts to get on with their lives in the face of grinding poverty and lack of support from the government. I really don't see fatalism as a major part or the dominant part of the explanation for the situation which Haiti is today.
Think of the irony of Duvalier saying they were born to suffer because of Tonton Macoute and because of his family tyranny under the Duvaliers. Let me go to our callers, though, and let's bring in Vince as our first caller. Good morning, Vince.
Good morning. Does Professor Diamond have any actual historical examples where intervention by outsiders has ever turned a place like Haiti into the Dominican Republic? Not academic theory, actual examples.
Yes, good question. Is there any case where intervention by outsiders has been helpful more generally? Let me give you some examples. One example, there are people who will not like this example, but the people of Bangladesh will like this example. The country of Pakistan 40 years ago had two parts, the western half and the eastern half. And the view of the people in the eastern half, which is now Bangladesh, was that the western half governed for the benefits of the western half and mistreated people in the eastern half. Well, Bangladesh, the eastern half, had a war of independence helped by the Indian Army. The Indian Army invaded East Pakistan and helped Bangladesh become independent. And then the Indian Army pulled out of Bangladesh and let Bangladesh get on with its own affairs. So there's a case of one country helping another country become independent and then stepping aside. I would also regard United States aid to South Korea as having been a strongly positive force. South Korea today, South Korea 50 years ago was really poor. Today, South Korea is virtually a first world nation. And a lot of that, a lot of the credit goes to the South Koreans, but also a lot of the, some of the credit goes to the United States for the help that it provided. So yes, there are cases of helpful interventions along with all the other cases of destructive interventions.
Well, in your fourth chapter that we've been alluding to here this hour, you talk about Hispaniola being kind of divided like a knife, but all of these differences where you see border differences between, say, East and West Germany, North and South Korea, the Baltic Republics and Russia. And it's fascinating to see the differences that occur just as a result of those kind of dichotomies. I mean, that's really what you're focusing on here in terms of Haiti and the Dominican Republic.
That's right, yeah. Haiti is today a gripping story and a gripping tragedy that affects Haitians and countries affected by Haiti. But to an academic scholar and historian, this tragedy is an instructive tragedy because it illustrates the role of institutions. So there's a basic debate among historians and academics, how much of the state of a country is due to environment and geography, and how much is due to institutions and what people do. Well, these natural experiments of borders are an example of the effects of people. If you take an area that was initially more or less homogeneous, and you then draw a border down that area, or you remove the border, and you have different institutions on opposite sides of the border, you can see the effects of what people do. Haiti and the Dominican Republic is one example. To give you other familiar examples, the border between South Korea and North Korea, which was put in at the end of the Korean War around 1953, come back 56 years later, and North Korea today is desperately poor and isolated. South Korea is a booming economy. There's an example of the effect of human activities and institutions. Or to take another example, the border put between East and West Germany, Germany one country, divided in 1945 with very different political systems set up on the opposite sides. East Germany eventually crumbled, and it's now 20 years after the crumbling of East Germany and the reunification of Germany. But East Germany, as a result of those different institutions, the eastern part of Germany, as a result of those different institutions, is still quite a bit beyond Western Germany economically. And the expectation is that it's going to take another generation, at least, to even out those differences. So these experiments of borders, putting in and removing borders, illustrate that we don't have to be fatalistic. The people and their decisions really make a difference.
Here's a listener who points out, perhaps of real interest to you, Professor Diamond, that your book, Natural Experiments of History, has been available since January 15th on Amazon.com, and asks the question, can you make any parallels between the situation in Haiti and what occurred in New Orleans during Katrina, aside from both having been former French colonies, of course?
That's an interesting comparison. So the United States has had its own experience of natural disasters. San Francisco had its natural disaster of its fire. The East Bay had its natural disaster of its earthquake. Here in Los Angeles, we've had our natural disasters of earthquakes and fires and floods. And then New Orleans had its natural disaster of a flood. In the case of New Orleans, what we remember is the disappointing response of the U.S. government to New Orleans. We think of Katrina as an example of a failure, but the fact remains that the U.S. government and the state government of Louisiana intervened after Katrina so that the number of dead was only, and only, what, 3,000, one could say only that's an awful tragedy. But there was government intervention, even though it was weak intervention by American standards. In the case of Haiti, one has a government that just has not had the capacity to intervene, even in the relatively ineffective way that the United States government intervened after Katrina. So I take the contrast between New Orleans and Port-au-Prince, the current earthquake, as an example of the difference that it makes to have a natural disaster happening in a country with an effective government that can intervene and a country without such a government.
Well, you've already gone on the record as saying that environment plays less of a role than culture and history and certainly than who the dictators were in these two parts of the what was once the island, now the divided island. But here's a listener who says, it would appear that your guest sounds very much like an environmental determinist. Essentially, the fundamental argument of the environmental determinist was that aspects of physical geography, particularly climate, influence the psychological mindset of individuals, which in turn define the behavior and culture of the society that those individuals form. For example, tropical climates were said to cause laziness, relaxed attitudes, and promiscuity, while the frequent variability in the weather of the middle latitudes led to more determined and driven work ethics. As a graduate student in geography, many of my colleagues, along with myself, believe that determinism served to justify racism and imperialism. The experience of environmental determinism within the history of geography has left a scar on geography, with many geographers reacting negatively to any suggestion of environmental influences on human society. Does your guest believe that it is largely an environmental factor that has left Haiti in its unfortunate state, or can a long history of imperialism and racism be a larger contributing factor? Well, you've already said, as I indicated, that you didn't believe it was largely environmental, though environmental plays into it. But what about imperialism and racism? And,
sure.
And environmental determinism, for that matter.
Usually I work hard at trying to find areas of agreement with guests who call in. And in this case, I think it could be much more instructive for me to count the ways in which your caller has gone off the deep end. First of all, as you point out, far from saying that environment is the major factor in counting for the differences between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, I began by saying that environment is the minor factor and that social differences are the major factor. Secondly, environmental determinism is one of those words like incest. As soon as you say incest, people stop thinking clearly. Similarly, environmental determinism is equated with evil. The fact is that any person knows that the environment has an effect on human societies. There's not agriculture. People are not growing tomatoes at the North Pole because of the environment. There's also not booming agriculture in the deserts of Baja California because of the environment. There is booming agriculture in the central Valley of California because of the environment. So it's a no-brainer that the environment has big influences on human society. If you say that this is environmental determinism, namely that people should roll over and play dead, no, people don't roll over and play dead. They do the best they can, but the environment sets constraints. It is true that there was about a century ago a tradition in academia that equated environmental influences with racism, but we've gotten a long way beyond that. For your listener, to bring up points of view of a century ago is misinformed.
Actually, there are arguments on the other side as well. I remember W.J. Cash in his book about the South, what he calls the psychohistory of the South, says that one of the reasons that Southern plantation owners and slave owners became entrenched in the institution of slavery was because they had a lot of time and ease with which they could be indolent. The weather was good and easy and all of that. So it kind of complements the other side of the perspective. I want to get to more of your calls, though, and let me go to Belvedere. William, good morning.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm glad that we're not limiting ourselves to discussing things that happened 100 years ago. Because something hasn't been mentioned, which I think is very here and now and relevant as opposed to there and then. This is here and now. Could Dr. Diamond comment on what he feels is represented by the fact that the so-called Electoral Commission in Haiti has refused, ever since Aristide was ousted, to allow his party to run for the Senate? Right now, in February, there's an election scheduled to to have all 97 seats in the Haitian Senate up for grabs, and the Electoral Commission has refused to even allow Aristide's populist party to appear on the ballot. And what that represents and what kind of significance that has in terms of the people being able to express themselves in a productive way.
Some thoughts on that, Jared Diamond?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's a very good question, a very good comment, an astute comment. It points up the fact that the solution to Haiti's problems is going to come partially from outside aid, but the major part of the solution is going to have to come from the Haitian people themselves, the governmental institutions that they set up, and what their government does. Here again, contrast Haiti with the Dominican Republic. As your call points out, the electoral laws in Haiti are not fair laws. In the Dominican Republic, on the other side of the island, the Dominican Republic really is a functioning democracy. For about the last dozen years, after the dictator Trujillo was assassinated, the first Dominican presidents after Trujillo used electoral fraud, but the elections for the last dozen years or so in the DR have been fair. And the proof that they're fair is that for the last dozen elections, the Dominican president has run for re-election and he's usually been defeated. And every time that he's defeated, he does not stage a coup, but he gracefully retires. So the Dominican Republic is a functioning democracy, which Haiti is not yet. Haiti is the solution to Haiti's problems is partly going to have to come from the efforts of the Haitian people to create a functioning democracy there, just as did the Dominicans.
And let me thank William for his call. In fact, when you talk about the functioning democracy in the Dominican Republic, you also mentioned Pedro Martinez and Sammy Sosa. Any thoughts about why the Dominican Republic is so successful in producing outstanding baseball players? I mean, I don't know any from Haiti, do you?
No, I don't. Partly it's one could say a cultural accident of baseball getting entrenched in the Dominican Republic, but also its economic connections. The Dominican Republic is richer. There are baseball training camps. The United States, American baseball teams are interested in investing in the Dominican Republic because it's a relatively stable place where their investment is going to succeed, and they're not interested in investing in Haiti where their investments are less likely to succeed. But I would just point out, as a former Bostonian, you can hear it in my form of Bostonian, that the Dominican Republic is not only the world's third leading exporter of avocados and a major exporter of flowers, but it's also the world's leading exporter of great baseball players.
Some listeners sending questions in, and here's one sort of dovetailing on the last comments from our caller, William in Belvedere. Julia says, how has U.S. military intervention in Haiti affected its poverty? And what about U.S. opposition to Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the democratically elected socialist Haitian leader who would have empowered the poor, writes this listener.
U.S. military intervention has affected both sides of the island, both Haiti and the Dominican Republic. From President Woodrow Wilson during the First World War onwards, there were American troops on and off in both sides of the island for a couple of decades. On the Dominican side, paradoxically, the evil dictator Trujillo came to power because the United States was concerned with setting up an effective Dominican peacekeeping force, an effective Dominican police force, and we trained a very well-trained police force in the Dominican Republic whose head was a gentleman called Rafael Trujillo, who then parlayed his leadership of the police force into becoming president and dictator. In recent decades, the United States again has had military interventions in Haiti and the Dominican Republic, not because we wanted to take over either part, but because both parts had serious problems and we wanted to intervene for at least purportedly selfless reasons. The reasons that there are now American troops in Haiti is not because we want to take over Haiti, but simply to keep the airport open and to be able to have planes flying in and out and to have a peacekeeping force and to be able to evacuate patients who desperately need surgery to U.S. medical facilities.
Again, we're talking to Jared Diamond. His new book is Natural Experiments of History. And another listener, Chris, writes, what is the effect of Haiti's high population growth rate on its economic status? Is its poverty largely the product of a demographic trap like in Afghanistan and Gaza? Is the Catholic Church's opposition of birth control a contributor?
It is a contributor. I would not say that Haiti's poverty is largely a result of its population, but that's part of the story. The Haitian part of the island has about a little more than half the area of the Dominican part of the island, and yet Haiti had, until a million Haitians moved to the Dominican Republic, Haiti had more people than the Dominican side. So the population density in the Haitian side is double that in the Dominican side. That means that whatever natural resources you have, they are spread over twice as many people on the Haitian side. It's also true, I regret to say, that the Catholic Church has opposed family planning in Haiti, just as it has around the world. In that sense, that's contributed to Haiti's problems and to the role of population growth. If Haiti had one-third as many people as it did now, it would be in much better shape with much less grinding poverty.
Well, right on that point, I'm just going to read an email from a listener, Wanda, who writes, the first building that the international community should erect in Haiti is a family planning clinic. The doubling time for the country is about 35 years. It is sheer stupidity to advance grandiose schemes like a Marshall Plan for Haiti while ignoring the import of reducing family size. And let's go to more of your calls. We'll go to Deborah. Good morning.
Good morning. I've learned that until fairly recently, Haiti had, and I don't know if they were nationalized, its own flour mills and cement production facilities using local limestone deposits. Those facilities were closed so that Haiti became less self-sufficient and now must import those basic commodities, i.e. from us. My question is, why can't we or the World Bank, whoever, offer aid that develops self-sufficiency of nations instead of captive labor forces and dependent markets for our exports?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a complicated question. How do you develop self-sufficiency in a country that lacks much of the infrastructure for self-sufficiency? You have to start somewhere. Some people start somewhere with good intentions of developing self-sufficiency in Haiti. There are also people who are interested in developing Haiti for their own interests. That even happens within Haiti itself. The Haitian elite, regrettably, often has not been concerned with developing Haiti for the benefit of the mass of the Haitian population, but instead developing Haiti for their own self-interest.
Let me thank the caller and go to another email from Tom, who says it gets tiring to hear speaker after speaker on NPR blame events of two centuries ago on the current economic situation in Haiti. One thing that your current guest has failed to point out are the free market policies that the Dominican Republic has now followed for nearly two decades, as well as the even older network of free trade zones to provide a reliable environment for domestic and foreign investors to produce exports. Jared Diamond.
Well, as a historian, yeah, it's a good question. Why blame events of two centuries ago? Why not focus on the present? It's perfectly true that in order to solve the present situation, you got to solve the present problems. But what makes history fascinating and important is that what happens two centuries ago really made a difference. What happened in the United States in 1776 and what our first president, George Washington, did has had influences that persist in the United States today. That's why history is not just a fascinating discipline, it's a discipline of great practical interest, because history really does make a difference.
Or as Faulkner said, I'm paraphrasing, the past is not past, words to that effect. We're going to go up to Meredith, New Hampshire for our next caller. Rick, join us.
Good morning. I have flown into Haiti numerous times, and I've also flown into the Dominican Republic. And from the air, as you look down, it's so barren on the west side of the island. And then once you get over the mountains, it's very lush and green. And I wondered if your guests could comment, really, on how the distribution of natural resources has influenced their struggle to overcome the poverty.
Well, it gets back to what we started talking about, doesn't it? Deforestation, largely. Derek Diamond?
Yeah, your caller's comment is a vivid one, that your caller's flown into both sides, and it's brown on one side and it's green on the other. Why is it green on the Dominican side? A minor part of the reason is that it's wetter and less steep. But the other reason, the bigger reason why it's green on the Dominican side, is that Trujillo wanted to become rich in any way possible, and one way to become rich was forests. So Trujillo made sure, with the help of Swedish advisors, that the pine forests on the Dominican side were very well managed sustainably, so that he, Trujillo, would have a source of income forever. And those well-managed pine forests of the Dominican side are still standing, whereas on the Haitian side, the pine forests were knocked down long ago.
And let me thank the caller. We're coming toward the end of the program, and here's a listener who asks perhaps a very appropriate question to end with, and a difficult question, a vexing one to be sure, but the question is, what are the best things that the government and people of Haiti can do to build a thriving economy and society, and what can we do to help?
What can we do to help? What can we outsiders do to help? There are some immediate things that we can do to help desperate need, and those are things that we're doing now, which are to provide medical aid, to provide food immediately, to provide security. In the long term, though, what can we do to help? Well, we, the United States, we Dominicans, we Canadians, we French, Haiti does not have the financial resources to solve its own problems. Haiti needs help from the outside world. What we can do in the long run is to provide help. Perhaps that help had best be funneled through the United Nations, which doesn't carry the political baggage that the United States does through its history of Haiti. But the future of Haiti is going to depend upon a combination of outside help, but also the efforts of the Haitian people themselves. Haitian people are bold, they are courageous, they will need all of their courage and boldness to solve the bad cards that history has dealt them.
Jared Diamond, so good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jared Diamond, professor of geography. His new book it is out, apparently, on Amazon, Natural Experiments of History. We are coming up on another hour of Forum, and in the hour ahead, Alexandra Natapoff is going to be with us. She's a professor of law at Loyola School of Law and has written a book about snitching, criminal informants, and the erosion of American justice. Forum senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Paul Lancour, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.